You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko kēsta tōku ingoa, nui mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Datu Tuesday. I'm your host Caster, filling in for Tuesday Wire host Sarah, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in studio by producer Faith. If I can, coming up on the show, for Dear Science this week, our expert Professor Alan Blackman chats with us about the Voyager 1 getting really hot in space, breakfast impacting life expectancy, and nuclear fusion in palladium metal. For our weekly catch-up with the National Party, News and Editorial Director Joel spoke to MP Carl Bates about the recent budget documents that have shown an almost $8.5 billion hole in future funding, the government's expansion of support for those rough sleeping, and changes to Auckland Transport. Faith, what have you got for us today?
I spoke to epidemiologist and researcher Professor Jackie Benshop from Massey University about leptospirosis in Aotearoa. I also spoke to tax expert Nick Miller from Tax Justice Aotearoa about big tech companies' tax avoidance.
He aha o whakaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395, or wae mai rane, give us a call in studio on 309 3879. Kawa e wareware e ahe ana koutou te whakarongo ki ēnei kōrero anō. Hei pakehere rokiroki mā runga i te pae tukutuku o Erirangi Poho me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more as always by podcast on the 95BFM website 95BFM.com. Now let's get into the show.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
It is time for Dear Science indeed, and what a lovely afternoon it is for some science. Well, not that lovely, I suppose. It's a bit dreary outside.
It is. Welcome back, Caster. Goodness
yeah.
me.
Yeah. Cool. Not for welcome back, both of you.
Not for long, but I'll be filling in this week, and I'm pretty familiar with some science, but not these stories.
Okay.
So I'll need you to fill us all in.
Okay, I shall do my best.
Yeah, so the Voyager 1, we've heard about the Voyager 1 a few times before.
Yeah, we have.
But
yeah.
It's going through a bit of trouble, or it has been, right?
you're right. We do tend to talk a little bit about Voyager 1 because it is astonishing. So just, you know, for a bit of background, 48 years and 3 days ago it was launched. So this was back when Jimmy Carter was still president of the USA. Yeah. Muldoon was prime minister of New Zealand,
yeah,
you know.
A good while ago.
A wee while ago. I'm probably about the only person in the building currently who remembers that, probably, I'm guessing. So this was launched, as I say, in 1977, 815 kilos. So that puts it about the size of a small car. And at the moment, it is a mind-boggling 25 billion kilometres away. 25 billion kilometres away.
So for context, how far are, you know, planets in our solar system?
We're well past them.
Right.
We are and truly past
well
them.
Well past, got it.
And we are travelling, or it is travelling at 17 kilometres a second.
Jeez, that's quite fast.
Which means it can go around the world in 40 minutes. Okay, so it's moving.
Yeah.
It's moving. And at the present time, it takes almost a day. It's about 23 hours for radio signals traveling at the speed of light to reach it. So, you know, it's a hell of a long way away. It's an astonishing piece of human ingenuity.
Yeah.
Just incredible. Now, in 2012, it basically got sort of to the far reaches of our solar system. So it was sort of getting to the point where It crossed a thing called the heliopause. And the heliopause is kind of where our solar system ends and sort of interstellar space begins, sort of roughly. Okay, so it's where the sun's influence sort of ends, let's say.
Yeah.
And interstellar space begins. And so we didn't know a lot about what things were like out there, because you sort of think, well, space, it's big, it's dark, it's cold, not a heck of a lot happening out there. And by cold, we're sort of talking about negative 270 degrees Celsius.
About as close to as cold as it gets.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. Absolutely. So so that was sort of the feeling that, out there, it's, you know, there's not going to be a heck of a lot happening. So, but NASA have just released new data while they can before they get shut down by those, you know, intellectual luminaries who are in charge of the USA at the moment.
Yeah.
But these new data that NASA found, it shows that Voyager 1 is currently experiencing temperatures, excuse me, and I say that in inverted commas, between 30,000 and 50,000 degrees Celsius.
And that's probably not what it was designed for,
no,
I'd imagine.
No, indeed not. And that's extraordinarily hot in our sort of sense of the word.
Yeah.
The way that we would perceive heat.
Right. But and for the Voyager,
It's a bit different. Mm. The way that we perceive heat relies on the fact that our atmosphere is full of stuff, let's say.
Right.
So molecules of air that can, well, molecules of oxygen, nitrogen in the air that can basically transmit heat, okay, by sort of by convection, okay. And they don't have that out in outer space.
No, nothing there.
There's pretty much nothing there. There's not nothing.
Right.
There's pretty much nothing, though, okay?
Got it. Okay.
And, but even so, what they are seeing, or what Voyager 1 is seeing, is this: these supposed temperatures of 30 to 50,000 degrees Celsius. And these arise as a result of these extraordinarily energetic particles, charged particles that are coming from the sun, and they seem to be hitting matter, of which there's not a heck of a lot, out in the interstellar region, okay? So there's interstellar material out there. Again, not a lot of it, so these collisions are not exactly
big, funny rocks and that sort of thing.
Well, more like tiny particles and stuff, really. Okay.
Right.
So we're talking sort of tiny particles colliding with tiny particles. But these collisions have huge, huge energy. And if this was sort of translated into sort of the conditions in our atmosphere and everything, then we would be looking at these ridiculously high temperatures of 30 to 50,000 degrees Celsius. So basically, this has caused maybe a rethink of what we think is actually going on out there. So, you know, the idea was that it was a very, very cold and boring place. But these data seem to say, right, well, no, that's absolutely not the case.
Might be hot and boring.
Well, it's, you know, very, very violent collisions, and it's a turbulent place, perhaps more so than the very dull and boring place that they thought.
Yeah, and we know there's stuff on the Voyager, right? That's my first concern, right? What's going to happen to all of our stuff?
All of our stuff?
Yeah.
In terms of,
well, it's quite hot. Does the heat
But that's the beauty of it, there's not enough of these collisions that getting that particular heat. But, you know, translating it to our conditions, yes, it would be really, really, really hot.
Yeah.
But there's so few of these collisions.
It's not actually.
They
are
very, very violent, okay? Mm. And they would give temperatures like that. So, you know, maybe we're going to have to rethink our ideas of what deep space means. And we've just got to keep making the most of Voyager until it's basically going to die around 2036, they reckon. Mm. So that's when the power supply is just not going to be sufficient to keep it all running. They've turned off instruments already.
Yeah.
So it's running on its bare bones at the moment, and it's telling us all these incredible things about a place that we just, you know, can't even imagine.
Yeah.
So incredible stuff. Absolutely incredible stuff. Mm. Yeah.
And then
this
next story, breakfast impacting life expectancy. We call it the most important meal of the day.
We do,
right?
We do.
But maybe even more important than we thought before.
Indeed. And this, I guess, you often sort of with these stories wonder how people get the idea to study these sorts of things. Mm. And this is another one, you know, the timing of your meals. Who would think that the timing of your meals would make a difference to anything?
To life expectancy of all things as well.
Absolutely. Well, thankfully, some workers in the UK, the USA, and Turkey have got together, and that's what they studied. They thought, okay, let's have a look at the timing of meals, and let's see what impact this has. Mm. And, you know, this is just one of a squillion variables that are out there of things that you could study that may or may not have an effect on life expectancy and stuff. And basically what they found in a nutshell was that there's a possible link between the overall health status of older people and, believe it or not, the time that they have breakfast.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Which is amazing. And you might think, oh, yeah, blah, blah, blah. You know, this is a little study, pseudoscience.
Yeah.
Well, okay, have I got news for you? So they studied 2,945 older people, so that's ages 42 to 94. get this, over a 20-year period. 20 years.
Wow, long study.
Yeah.
20
so
years.
So we've got a whole pile of evidence.
Yeah. So this is not just sort of a flash in the pan study. Mm. This is over a hell of a long time.
Yeah.
With a lot of people, you know, basically 3,000 people. And so their major findings. Okay, so they find that as people age, they tend to eat later.
Mm.
Okay. And so particularly breakfast and dinner.
Yeah.
Okay. So they tend to have breakfast later in the morning. Mm. They tend to have dinner later at night. Okay. And as people age, okay, so those having breakfast later were consistently found to have problems with depression and fatigue and with oral health.
Wow.
Oh, okay. That's quite interesting.
Bad oral health.
It's quite a trend these days. There's a lot of anti-breakfast people.
Yeah.
Doing intermittent fasting, whatever it is. Like, oh, just get breakfast. You know?
Yeah.
Like, that's a thing. How does that tie into it in some way?
Well, they'll probably need another 20-year study to figure that out.
Yeah.
I would guess. But, you know, this is basically it. This is a well carried out long term study, which, you know, has given results which are fairly probably incontrovertible, really.
Yeah.
So, and the late breakfasters everything have an increased risk of death.
And that's really unfortunate news because I'm personally a late breakfaster a lot of the time. Yeah. I wake up quite late some days, but I always have my breakfast.
Well,
and now I'm concerned.
Wow, I was going to say, no more brunching.
You need more 8 o'clock lectures, obviously.
Yeah.
To get you up.
I'm hoping not.
So, you know, the people who are what they call night owls, so the people who are late to bed,
yes,
late to rise,
yeah,
they're going to be in danger. You know,
they tend
to eat meals at later times.
This is a wake-up call.
Yeah.
And so they are more at risk. So, you know, as you say, what can we do about this? Mm. What would be wise to do in this case with these results?
Mm.
And basically encourage older adults to have consistent meal schedules and, you know, don't breakfast late. You know, get up, you know, nice and early or whatever. Mm. Have your breakfast at a consistent time. Have your dinner at a consistent time. And that seemed to be the thing, that consistency and timing were seemingly important with basically your overall health. So
incredible
who
stuff.
Would have thunk it, you know?
Wow. And then
certainly not me.
This last thing, nuclear fusion and palladium metal, where do we even start?
Oh, yes. Well, speaking back to 1977 in the first story, we go back to 1989 now, and I'm still probably the only person in the building that can remember 1989.
Yeah, you might be.
I would think. Which is, anyway, there was this thing called cold fusion, which was all the rage those days.
We still talk about it.
Oh, we do, we do. And this was the most public example of scientists being so wrong. Absolutely,
right.
absolutely wrong. And the reason that they were so wrong was that if they were right, then the riches that would have occurred for them would have just been unimaginable. Instant Nobel Prize.
Got it.
And you'd probably be richer than, you know, probably most people on the planet,
because
this was going to be basically free energy out of a bucket of water. That was essentially the guts of it.
That's quite big.
That you could power the Earth on a bucket of water, basically.
Wow.
And that was because you were going to be replicating what's happening in the middle of the sun, this process called fusion.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. Which normally needs incredibly high pressures and incredibly high temperatures in order to occur.
But instead we're going to do it cold?
And they were claiming that they could do it at room temperature.
Wow. How do they get it wrong right now?
How did they get it
what
wrong?
I'm wondering.
They didn't measure their temperature correctly. They didn't they didn't stir their solution, apparently, while this reaction, whatever, was going on.
Right.
And that meant that the thermometer they used had sort of, it was just measuring hot spots. And they were saying, oh, look, we're getting out more heat than we're putting in. And so therefore it must be nuclear fusion and blah, blah, blah. And what they were using was this metal called palladium.
Yes.
And they were sort of filling it full of hydrogen gas or deuterium gas, which is a form of hydrogen. And they proposed that for some reason that these guys would get so, so close together under such high pressure in this palladium metal that they get so close, close, and then they would just fuse and give off lots of heat. Anyway, they were proven wrong. However, you have a quick look around the internet and there are still people who say, oh, yes, this is right,
cold
this is absolutely
possible.
Right. Oh, right. Yeah, absolutely. So a bunch of scientists in Canada have shown, yes, actually, you can.
We can do it.
You can do it.
And we've solved it. We've solved the energy crisis.
Well, no, you haven't. No, you haven't. So one of the things that was required of this was excess heat. In other words, you get out more heat than you put in.
Yes.
The other thing that was required was neutrons.
Neutrons.
If this fusion reaction was going, you should get these things called neutrons ejected,
right,
which are neutral particles that are part of the nucleus, and they should come flying out at high speeds. Which wouldn't have been good for you. You probably would have, you know, irradiated yourself with neutrons.
Yeah,
and that's never good. But these Canadian team has basically done a very, very similar thing. They've used palladium metal, they've pumped it full of deuterium, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they have found that they see neutrons. Okay, and so that's a pretty good,
seems like a good indicator,
marker,
yeah,
that this is actually happening. Okay, now before everybody gets way too excited,
I'm getting a little bit excited.
Remember, we need to get out more energy than we're putting in.
Yes.
Okay, so in this,
so output does not equal input. Well, no, not in this case.
Well usually, usually, surely isn't output less than input.
I feel like yes, absolutely.
That's
it
one
is
of the laws of energy.
That is the law of thermodynamics.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right.
So they are putting in 15 watts 15 and
watts?
They're getting out 10 to the minus 9 of a watt.
That seems like quite a lot less.
So that's about 100 billion fold less. Okay.
Right.
So, we're basically not solving the energy crisis like this. I think what they've done is that they've shown that there is an unusual process going on. It's only 15% higher than background, so that, you know, what they're seeing is a tiny, tiny, tiny effect. It's very, very small. It's nowhere near what would be required to do this. But basically it's saying that, yep, there is something funny going on here. This is probably worth more study, which I'm absolutely sure they will do. Yeah. And this, as opposed to 1989, is a good piece of science, okay? And the problem in 1989 was, as I say, it was all to do with the money side of things, that they would have got unimaginable riches. And the problem was that there were two groups who were competing at the time. And somebody had to be first. Now, normally when you announce a scientific breakthrough, you publish it.
Yes.
You write a manuscript, you send it to a journal, it goes through peer review, they say yay or nay, blah, 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 blah. This was way too important for that, so they announced it at a press conference. Wrong thing to do.
Especially if you're wrong.
Yes,
right?
Yes, indeed. Mm. And sadly, the names Pons and Fleischmann, and they were both, you know, they were both basically sort of stand-up scientists and stuff, but they just got it horribly, horribly wrong. And, Don't do that.
Don't
let money be the ruler.
Yeah. All right. Well, cold fusion, maybe not out of the books yet, but definitely not what it's all cracked up to be.
Yeah.
And as with Dear Science, we can expect maybe some further things to find out.
Oh, we always follow up on Dear Science.
Yeah.
Hell yes.
And it'll be exciting to hear, not with me, but with Sarah, which will be exciting for you guys to hear in 2 weeks when you're back. All right.
Okay.
Well, thank you, Alan, for joining us today. Thank you, Mota, as always. And thank you, Science. We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the B.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Wow, we get along so well. I feel like I've known you my whole life.
I know, it's crazy. I'd love to see you again.
Sorry, I just have to ask. Your hoodie is so random. What is 95BFM?
Oh, I knew this was too good to be true.
What? Wait, where are you going?
No!
Show the world exactly who you are with our range of classic 95BFM merch. From the BSA slogan t-shirt to ringer tees and hoodies, get yours now at twotonesmerch.co.nz.
Jazz cigarette, Bob Hope. Durbage, Jar Rastafari, Wacky Backy, Mez, Mary Jane, Marley, Sheba Cheba.
Whatever you call it,
Muggles.
Marijuana Media has you covered. Every Thursday on 95BFM Drive, join Chris Fowley from Normal for the good word on law reform, cannabis in the media, and the latest in green science. Marijuana Media, 4:20 every Thursday on 95BFM Drive, thanks to The Hemp Store. Visit them at 253 K Road or shop online at hempstore.co.nz.
Hey, New Zealand artists! Here's some good news, straight from the horse's mouth.
We know it can be hard out there, so we just made it a whole lot cheaper for artists to advertise on 95BFM.
We've just launched new advertising packages that offer big discounts for Kiwi musicians, theatre makers, filmmakers, dancers, writers, arts orgs,
or anything similar, kind of like that or in between.
Check out all the details on 95BFM.com to see if you qualify, or email the sales team for more info.
Hey, Captain. Do you think we'll ever find the land of the good groove?
Patience, Sonny Jim.
It's just, we've been floating on this dinghy for months, since the crew mutiny.
Patience, Sonny Jim.
It's concerning that you keep repeating that. I don't even think my name is Sonny Jim. Is that my name? Captain?
Patience, Captain. Sonny Jim.
I am Sonny Jim. We are both Sonny Jim. Lando, we made it. Let's drink some more seawater to celebrate.
Land of the Good Groove with Murray Kamek. Bringing a solid hour of funk, electricity, and soul to your Friday afternoons. Land of the Good Groove, 1 till 2 p.m. every Friday, right here on 95BFM.
Fruit cut moon love, water over fire. Ring set low down, ghost and choir. Red gut of blood, get it real desire. Met in pin and knotted off wire. Beggars sleep on one bus feed. Wake to make new signs. Names I keep for different things are trading place tonight. Tie back and hand, rivulets of tire. Rinsing grain ink, tin back high. Sing gate, hang eight, run now, die. Rig, wake, kid, ache, no sleep, bar. Beggars sleep on one bus feed. Wait to make new signs. Names I keep for different things are trading place tonight.
Last night I went to Candy's house and took them pills again. asleep in your arms and woke up here.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with National MP Carl Bates.
Welcome back to The Wire. Recent budget documents have shown an almost $8.5 billion hole in future funding. Most of these cost pressures were in education, the Defence Force, health, disability support services and transport. As well as this, the government has outlined their plans to assist those rough sleeping. This follows the government previously tightening the eligibility for those seeking emergency housing, which critics say has resulted in an increase in those sleeping on the street. This follows the release of the Homeless Insights report, showing a large spike in those sleeping without adequate accommodation. And Auckland Transport is set to face some large changes. For our weekly catch-up with the National Party's Carl Bates, News and Editorial Director Joel spoke to Bates about these topics, starting with the hole in future funding.
Prime Minister Christopher Luxon says he is quite relaxed about the $8.45 billion fiscal hole reported by the Treasury. Could you speak to some of the cost pressures highlighted in their report and why New Zealanders shouldn't see this as a concern?
So firstly, it's not a budget hole. It highlights the ongoing work around savings and achieving savings from the government's activities. It also underscores the importance of economic growth, because ultimately, when we grow our economy, we're able to reinvest in health and education, and that's what this government's focused on doing.
Will the government be considering the Treasury advice to work towards a budget surplus for the medium term as an essential step towards alleviating financial stress?
So, as the Minister of Finance said last year, you know, you can't solve 6 years of bad budgets in one or in two budgets. Our two budgets have been responsible, getting rid of wasteful spending and helping Kiwis and businesses get ahead. And that's what this government is focused on doing.
Are there any budget decisions announced by this government specifically that you think could have been approached differently to improve New Zealand's fiscal health?
I think the budget was a solid response to where New Zealand finds itself right now, focusing on reprioritising spending, ensuring that we're investing in the social services that New Zealanders expect, at the same time as supporting the economy to grow through policies like the investment boost, which will ultimately enable the government to invest further into health, education and other social services.
So just to clarify, you don't think there's any decisions whatsoever about the budget from this government that you think could have been approached differently to improve the country's fiscal health at all whatsoever?
I think the budget was a comprehensive package of policies that have enabled New Zealand to continue to get back on track. And as the budget unfolds and is implemented through this year, we'll see that continuing to occur for the New Zealand economy.
Moving on to our next topic relating to the increased support for rough sleepers, can you talk about what the timeline looks like for the provision of this support for those rough sleeping, such as the expansion of the Housing First program, additional funding and the Ministry of Social Development's assessments of beneficiaries for social homes, etc.?
So the government's made these announcements in the last week, and I'm sure that ministers will be outlining the timeframes for those for the implementation as the policy is unfolded and implemented. I think the focus here is it's just another example of this government identifying need and ensuring that resources are put where need is in a practical way that's going to ensure a positive outcome for those affected.
How has the advice and mahi of grassroots operations been incorporated into the planning and implementation around the support for rough sleepers?
I'm not directly involved in the development of that policy, so I'm not sure exactly the process that the ministers and their advisors followed in relation to your question. What I can say is across the country, members of the caucus, including myself, meet regularly with grassroots and social service organisations who are engaged with rough sleepers across the country, and feed that back into our ministers and colleagues here in Wellington.
How will the government be measuring the success of these changes?
It's a question you have to direct to the relevant minister, because it's a policy that the ministers are putting in to support those who are rough sleeping around New Zealand, focused on first, as well as focused on things like those looking to get into homes, and changes for the accommodation supplement. So it's wider than just rough sleepers. But the measurement of success of that policy is a good opportunity for you to direct those questions to the minister.
Finally, Auckland Transport is set to see a shake-up occur later this year. Can you talk about some of the key issues relating to the governance of Auckland's public transport that these changes seek to address?
So the reforms are about restoring democratic accountability and ultimately ensuring Aucklanders can hold their elected representatives responsible for transport policies. It's a real key focus of ensuring that we get the planning and policy work correct in Auckland by shifting those functions from Auckland Transport to Auckland Council. The council ultimately will become the road controlling authority and will deliver transport capital projects while maintaining the important transport infrastructure in Auckland.
As responsibility moves from a dedicated organisation to councillors and an Auckland Regional Transport Committee, are there any concerns that councillors involved won't be able to dedicate the necessary time or resources to ensuring tangible improvements to Auckland Transport?
The Auckland Transport Committee will be made up of an equal share of Auckland Council elected members and ministerial appointees alongside an independent chair, and I'm sure all of those involved in that committee will give it sufficient time, energy and effort to deliver the outcomes that Auckland commuters and transport users expect.
And what kind of accountability or consultation mechanisms will be in place for Aucklanders to support the transition and implementation of this governance shift?
We'll bring it back to having elected members directly involved in the setting of that transport policy and planning. It means that Aucklanders will have the ability to hold their elected officials accountable through elections, like we've got the local body elections coming up now, as a way of communicating their satisfaction or otherwise with the implementation of planning and policy for the transport network in Auckland.
That was the National Party's Carl Bates speaking on the $8.5 billion hole in future funding, the government's expansion on supporting those rough sleeping, and Auckland Transport's changes.
That was our weekly chat with National MP Carl Bates.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
Aotearoa continues to have one of the highest leptospirosis rates among developed countries, with flooding, notably the Hawke's Bay floods in 2023, being one of the main catalysts. A recent study shows that other causes include exposure to rodents, working with uncovered cuts, and handling of livestock. The carried lepto strains are currently not protected by any existing vaccines. Last week, I spoke to researcher and epidemiologist Professor Jackie Benshop from Massey University about the disease and what needs to be done.
For those that aren't familiar with the disease, can you explain what leptospirosis is?
Leptospirosis, and I'll call it lepto, it's a disease that people get from animals. Animals can get it too, but we're going to just talk today about the disease in people. And it's nasty. People who get it tend to present with three things together: a high fever, extreme fatigue, and a pounding headache. 60% of people who get this disease end up going to hospital. They stay on average for 4 or 5 nights, and in one of the surveys that we've done, half of the people are still not right a year later. So it has a long recovery, and it's also a nasty disease early on. In New Zealand, there's a strong occupational pattern to lepto because people get it from animals. We tend to see more cases in people exposed to animals, farmers and meat workers.
How does flooding affect the risk of lepto?
Yeah, that's a great question, because this is something very well recognised overseas, but only recently recognised here in Aotearoa. overseas, the most common associated animal with leptospirosis is rats. In fact, it can be called, you know, rat-borne fever. We certainly see an association with rodents here, but we more largely see an association with livestock. But flooding is really interesting. First of all, flooding brings animals and people to higher ground together. Flooding also can damage people's skin, say on their, you know, on their legs and hands, and that's how the leptobacteria gets into people, through cuts and cracks in the skin, or just through skin that's soggy or damaged. Other things that happen in flooding, we often pile up, and you might recall seeing this, understandably why we do this after floods. We pile up rubbish that's been damaged by floods, household goods, damaged food and so on. We bring it all together to get picked up by a dumpster. That creates a place for rodents to proliferate and for rodents, you know, to eat, find each other and to make more rodents. So you tend to see an increase in rodents after flooding, and they carry the lepto bug. But there's different strains of lepto. In New Zealand, there are strains in our domestic animals, particularly the ruminants, sheep, cattle, and deer. And we saw this in Hawke's Bay. The leptobacteria really likes the water. It swims, and it's actually not the most hardy bacteria. It's not that difficult to kill or get rid of necessarily, but when it's released from animals and it's in the environment, if the sun's on it, it'll die away. But if it's a moist environment, the bacteria will move around and be quite happy to live for quite some time in water or mud. And as I say, in Hawke's Bay, we saw outbreaks of lepto both in sheep and cattle, but also in humans after the floods. So the flooding really adds a complexity to this disease.
And how does exposure to rodents or livestock contribute to lepto outbreaks?
Yeah, well, lepto is an interesting disease, and that really the only way people can get it is from the urine of animals, being exposed to that, either and the bacteria that's in there, or through contaminated water. In this country, those livestock and pests, rodents, possums, you know, the mustelids, they carry the lepto. So the how is interesting. It can be direct. You're standing behind a cow, perhaps putting the cups on and milking her, and of course she might urinate on you, or you're assisting a female animal in birthing an animal, and there could be some urine contamination there. Other exposures, if you are dressing a carcass or handling kidneys, there can be urine contamination onto your skin or splashing up into your face. If you're emptying traps or dealing with rodents or possums, skinning or dealing with any animals that you might hunt, it's the urine that you really have to watch out for. And understandably, even though we recommend wearing gloves, we recommend covering wounds for these reasons, it doesn't take many of these leptobacteria to enter a person, and then depending on other factors around the person, they can become very unwell within a week or two after that.
What steps do public health officials need to take to address the outbreak? And do you think that a vaccine will be developed?
Yeah, we'll talk about the public health officials first and then move to the vaccine. In terms of public health, we're really fortunate. We're here at the Vet School. We're really highly linked with each of the public health units, and they connect with us. In fact, it was actually a really nice sign of that connection when, not that long after Cyclone Gabrielle, both public and Māori health in Hawke's Bay connected with us and said, actually, we think we're probably going to see some lepto because we've worked with them before. Together with them, we developed material and advice both for GPs and for the general public about keeping themselves safe. So public health have a huge role to play there. And in fact, even more recently in the terrible floods in Nelson Tasman, the Nelson Tasman public health people got in touch with us too around messaging and around keeping people safe. Things that might include, say, you know, if people are out, say, gathering kai in waterways, or if there's food that's been contaminated with flood water, just to be aware that it could also be contaminated with the leptobacteria. So that's public health, they work closely with us, and that's great. In terms of a vaccine, there are really good vaccines available for livestock and for dogs and other domestic animals. One of the issues with the vaccine, in terms of is there one for humans, is that the vaccines are kind of strain specific, and there are at least 7 different strains of lepto and different vaccines. In New Zealand, they don't cross protect against each other. We don't have a vaccine for humans in New Zealand. There are vaccines internationally in very few countries for just one strain and in certain situations. For example, people who work in the sewers in France are offered a vaccine against the rat strain. But there is not a universal human vaccine available, nor a universal vaccine that covers all strains for animals. And that is an area of research for sure, but not in our laboratory.
How does this study highlight the specific public health needs of rural communities in Aotearoa?
Rural communities have specific needs, absolutely. I think the messages that we hear are true, that people are, particularly if you think about people, say, on farms or people who might be working, say, shifts. For a start, it's hard to get away from the farm or hard to get away from the chain to seek help. So in terms of rural communities, I think raising awareness, if possible, thinking about approaches where people can perhaps feel comfortable, whether it's an employment situation or otherwise, to recognise they're not well and to seek help early. Recognising that you're not well and seeking help early isn't preventing lepto, but if it's detected early and treated, it's very responsive to antibiotics. And connecting with it early would generally mean, and treating it early would generally mean, people are likely to have a better outcome. I think other things about rural communities I found really interesting, just talking with people and the work that we do with these communities in relation to lepto, is, I suppose, in some ways, just sometimes how hard life can be, how stoic people are. A lot of the stories we hear, and we have interviewed a number of patients, and they've said things, oh, I got up in the morning, there's mostly men saying this, but some women too, and I felt really terrible. I felt like wretched, they might say that. I still went out and did this fencing, this job had to be done, I had to milk the cows, and then it's often those cases that actually they get to the point almost of collapse. So I think there's that community level. There's also things in individuals, which means that there may be reasons why people, you know, continue to work when perhaps others might be in a position where they can seek help.
That was Professor Jackie Benshop on leptospirosis in Aotearoa.
We'll be right back after the short break. Keep it on the B.
I'm not gonna die on this hill. Or maybe I will. Summer's over, it's sad, but I'm still burning bad. Can't keep calling it grief or hoping it's brief when you live in the world. But I live underneath. Who will water the plants? Are they just gonna be another thing that dies from spending time around me? So I'll probably be still. You said you're not feeling me. Who
gave you the nerve? Said you're not feeling free, like I'm caging a bird. I got heartbreak for jet lag, and you got free. I got heartbreak for jet lag, and you got free. I got heartbreak for jet lag, and you got free. I got heartbreak for jet lag, and you got free. Could it be you forgot me holding you when you cried, or driving you to the nurse when your body was fried? I was a healer for you if anything went wrong, but you're not broken now, so you wanna move on. I got heartbreak for jet lag, and you got free. I got heartbreak for jet lag, and you
got free. Having some solid time, if that's what you need, and staying sober, or at least sober now. Please take care of yourself. I love you. I'll see you soon.
Modern love breaks me. am entering my seventh decade. It's a big one.
That's a big birthday.
Oh my gosh. That's,
and you're spending your 70th birthday on Dear Science.
70th?
Yeah.
Not yet.
Oh, right. Sorry. I miscounted.
Wire.
Tax Justice Aotearoa is calling out multinational big tech companies that are making billions in Aotearoa and paying very little tax through tax minimization practices. I spoke to Nick Miller from the organization about the tax loopholes, its consequences, and what actions the government needs to take. What specific tax loopholes are big tech companies using, and how should they be closed?
Yeah, in the report that we've published, we identify three different techniques for tax minimization that are used by the tech companies. The first of these is one where they report their revenue in New Zealand and simply pay most of it away in what they call a service fee. Now, we say the way to tackle that is to look at whether all or part of that is actually a royalty, in which case under our existing rules, we can tax part of that payment or retain some tax. So that is one way you would challenge that kind of structure. Another technique is simply to inflate license fees or purchases, and again, we have existing laws which can tackle that. By reducing the amount that is paid out, or again by imposing withholding tax on royalty. Again, these are long-standing existing laws. And the third one is where the companies don't even book the revenue they earn in New Zealand actually in New Zealand. They actually book it overseas. And we want to see that revenue booked in New Zealand. We believe existing laws could be applied to make that happen, and then to see what the nature of their taxation liability was. So there are various ways in which we believe we can challenge this. So we're not just saying, well, this is terrible. We're saying, look, there is something we can do about it.
Alrighty, and the report estimated that Aotearoa loses hundreds of millions in tax revenue each year. Realistically, what could this pay for, and who is missing out because of this?
I think we say in our media briefing, you know, that this could pay for various things. It could, you know, over time, I mean, this well could amount to, say, $1 billion over 5 years. So, I mean, we're talking about paying for a hospital then, for example, or year by year paying for a lot of additional nurses or school teachers. So who's missing out? Well, I think we all are to some extent, because this is money that could be put to use. We think it's potentially 200 million or even more per year, and you know that's significant in any 1 year, but also if you take it over a period of time.
And why hasn't Inland Revenue held these companies accountable?
I think Inland Revenue probably was focusing on the digital services tax over the last few years. If you recall, it was looking at introducing draft legislation to put in a 3% digital services tax on some of these companies, and it was also looking potentially at other broad-based solutions, multinational solutions that the OECD was trying to put forward. But it doesn't look as though now, and that may well be why it hasn't taken any significant enforcement action over that period, because it was that there were potentially other solutions in the offing, but it doesn't look as though those are now going to see the light of day. So one would expect perhaps Inland Revenue to start looking at other avenues to challenge these minimisation structures.
What should the government be doing to ensure that these big tech companies aren't avoiding tax?
Well, I think the first thing is to enforce the laws that you have. If we have existing laws that can be used to challenge them, then we should use them. We should make sure that Inland Revenue provided with the correct resources, the right resources to be able to investigate the circumstances behind the, for example, some of the payments that are made offshore. I mean, this requires quite a lot of experience and expertise, so you need to have the right people on board to be able to do it. You also need the legal resources, and then you have to have the political will, and I guess this is something that, you know, the governments would have to think about to take these matters to litigation and test the law.
And if these are international companies, how can we make sure that they're playing by New Zealand's rules and laws?
Well, many of the laws that we talk about in the report are long-established principles of taxation, and they're not just New Zealand's laws. Other countries have very, very similar legislation, and they're underpinned by what is in our double taxation treaty. So it's not even so much New Zealand's laws. These are rules which are common in most countries, and you can see the effect of that, because if you look at the global filings of some of these big tech companies, they're actually in dispute with a lot of countries around the world in respect of the type of issues that we're talking about in the report as well. So we're not alone in this, I think is perhaps the message there.
That was tax expert Nick Miller from Tax Justice Aotearoa talking about big tech tax avoidance.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki māua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Tuesday Wire. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. Professor Alan Blackman, National MP Carl Bates, researcher and epidemiologist from Massey University, Professor Jackie Benshop, and Tax Justice Aotearoa's Nick Miller. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongana, thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4 with Jin.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.